risky business. Your weekly security briefing with Patrick Gray. Updating Tuesdays on itradio.com.au.
Hello and welcome to this special KiwiCon edition of Risky Business, recorded in Wellington, New Zealand. I'm Patrick Gray. This week's show is brought to you by Checkpoint Software, and I'm sure you all know who they are, and Checkpoint's Steve McDonald will be along in this week's sponsor interview to have a chat about recent changes to the EPL, or Evaluated Products List. On this week's show, you'll hear the panel I presented at the KiwiCon conference. I jumped the ditch again in 2008 to attend KiwiCon 2, another stellar event put together by the NZ crew. Big thanks to all the organisers and a big hello to all of the listeners who came up to me to say g'day. It was really great to meet all you guys and gals. A particular highlight this year of the conference was Tokemon, KiwiCon's hacking contest, on the evening of day one. There was, believe me, there was a lot of beer involved. A lot of free beer too, which is nice. These guys made a whole game out of a capture the flag style contest. Entrants had to capture tokens by hacking away at a series of systems on the local network. Now, some of these tokens were easy gets, but some of them were pretty hard. I don't think the entrants actually managed to capture all of the tokens by the end of the night, but the contest itself was unreal and a lot of fun for everyone who entered. So well done to all who were involved, especially Wolfie, who actually managed to win Tokemon. He also goes by the name of Sam Banks, so congratulations, Sam. He won the EPC donated by Insomnia Security as first prize. Now, the panel I assembled at KiwiCon consisted of Brett Moore, Paul Craig, and Peter Goodman. Each presented at the conference, and I regard each as world-class in their field. Peter did his presentation on biometrics, highlighting a raft of issues with the technology. He married the talk to some of the research he was involved in around e-passport security. And, of course, regular listeners would have heard my interviews with Peter about e-passport stuff. Now, Brett Moore's talk was a bunch of fun. He showed how massively ownable a lot of Citrix deployments are. As it turns out, it's pretty easy to obtain a list of anonymously accessible applications running on Citrix boxes. And from there, you can do stuff like run calc.exe and manipulate the help interface to run cmd.exe or command.com. And from there on in, it's just a case of privilege escalation, and then you're home and hosed. So it was a pretty scary talk for anyone running a Citrix deployment. The talk wasn't so much about a vulnerability per se, but it was more about exploiting misconfiguration and common misconfigurations at that. And finally, we get to Paul Craig, who's panelist number three, which, and believe me, I'll be podcasting at some point his presentation, because it was really a lot of fun. Paul created the Interactive Kiosk Attack Tool, or ICAT, which was publicly released at DEF CON this year. ICAT allows users to take over kiosks, whether they're pay-by-the-minute internet kiosks or the type you find in building lobbies. In the first part of Paul's talk, he went through what's been happening with ICAT, including listing some of the kiosks that have been owned with his tool. After that, he went straight for the motherlode with his talk, Who Got Owned? Through some fairly unsophisticated Google hacks, Paul was able to download around 3.3 gigabytes of botnet keylogger log files. So he captured banking logins, credit card information, webmail conversations, and more. But the really interesting part was the economics of his big haul. So despite capturing 3.3 gig of illicit data, he estimates it's only worth around $3,000. Still, some of the personal information he was able to grab out of these files was pretty extreme, not to mention all the logins and passwords to various web interfaces. Dudes surfing for shemale porn and stuff, and perhaps more interestingly, search terms like Paris Hilton shemale, which is a pretty scary thought. So thanks, Paul, for putting that one in the attendees' heads. And of course, this year, Paul was presenting in three parts. It was his Paul Craig Omnibus experience. And for his final trick, Paul showed the audience how you can exploit Windows Management Instrumentation, or WMI, to turn the operating system against itself. So you can actually create a fairly sophisticated Trojan by configuring WMI in the right way. You can even use stuff like VBScript to run this. And he called his version, or his incarnation of this Trojan, the Moth Trojan. It's a technique AV companies are going to have to start detecting in the future. And we'll have some more on Moth next week, including the release of a toolkit designed to break it. Now, it could be considered perhaps a bit controversial that Paul Craig didn't actually contact Microsoft to try to notify them of how he was using WMI to create a Trojan. And you'll hear me ask him about that in the panel. So I'll play the panel now, and I'll pick it up where I introduce the panelists. And before we get into the meaty stuff with the panel, you'll hear me have a quick chat with Adam Metalstorm Boileau, one of the organisers of the KiwiCon event. Paul Craig and Peter Goodman. But first off, metal. Conference organiser, Adam Boileau. Highlights?
Well, as always, Mr. Paul Craig, delivering the goods, as usual. Wild and rampant owners. Yeah, he's always good value, aren't you?
That's right.
Stress level this year?
Stress level this year, yeah, well, the last few days were pretty crazy, but now it's all come together well and good, I reckon.
All right. Okay. Well, I guess first off, we've got to talk to Paul first. And by the way, thank you for scheduling me after Paul, because, you know, this guy is actually a pretty hard act to follow. So, Paul, I guess the question that I'd like to ask you, which wasn't really covered in your talk, is why did you not notify Microsoft, or why did you not make an attempt to work with Microsoft when you'd made the decision to go public with Microsoft?
Really, that came down to whether or not this was a vulnerability or not. So Microsoft security approach is that if you have a vulnerability, you contact them, they resolve the vulnerability. If it's not classed as a vulnerability, they don't resolve it. So in the same sense of the Moth Trojan, you could use cmd.exe to do malicious things. WMI is essentially an extension of a method of executing commands on a Windows box. This is Microsoft functionality. This is typically meant for sysadmins. When your CPU fan stops, you want it to send you an email. You want it to do something. This is how it was designed. It's not my fault that I can turn there. You know, it's not a vulnerability.
How did you term it? Raping the world?
No, that was the other talk.
Oh, that was the other talk.
No. I know what you media type are like.
Yeah, you're twisting your words, making you out to be bad. So do you expect that some Microsoft dudes are going to, like, act on this? I mean, what really can they do from an OS perspective
From an OS perspective, I don't think WMI should be executing as a privileged user. I think it should be executing as a guest or an unprivileged user. I mean, obviously, that would fundamentally break a lot of things around the world. So I don't really think there's a whole lot you can do. I would say, or I would hope, that forensic companies would realize that this is a new attack vector and look at it as, you know, something that they should look for, something they should detect. And also AV companies. I would hope that AV companies would consider this as a new area to scan, maybe a WMI virus scanner or, you know.
This is something that, say, AV vendors should be able to tackle without doing too much?
If I run a tool, I want it to tell me if there's a non-standard Windows event consumer installed. I mean, that's pretty standard. Mm-hmm. For the average end user, dude at home, he's not going to go to MSDN and download the funky tools, and he's not going to figure that out. You want to run, like, your AVG to tell you, this is present.
You've been sitting on this for a little while now, haven't you?
Yes.
And what did you normally use this for? Was it just something you used in engagements with customers and things like that?
For a variety of things.
Messing with people?
Well, I mean, I am a security consultant, so I mean, if I use this on the job, then I use it on the job. This is one of my tricks. I've never used this maliciously, or I don't do things like that.
All right, well, let's go back to your earlier talk, which was the... Who got owned? I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Now, were you at all concerned? I mean, you obviously had access to a lot of private data there, and, yeah, it was in the public domain, but did the sort of privacy aspect... Did you feel a bit grubby rifling through people's personal shit? That's basically what
okay,
I'm
well... Me... No. Yeah, no, I'm just going to be honest. So, I mean... Because it was directory indexing enabled, it was in the Google cache. It was on the internet. It was there for everyone to see if you knew where to look. So, I mean, I didn't feel like I was invading on people's privacy. I felt like I was a passive observer in something that was happening. I happened to observe it, and I learned a lot from it. I mean, I didn't disclose this information to anyone else. I made sure the information I disclosed here, or the screenshots I showed here, blacked out anything that was sensitive. Short of a few names and phone numbers, there's nothing you couldn't get on the internet otherwise.
I guess one of the things that I found interesting about this, as a journalist, we try to look at everything from, you know, down low right up to the high-level stuff. And the economics of the underground is something that, it's very difficult to get a handle on what's going on. But it's interesting to me that you could capture 3.3 gigabytes I've intercepted data and make $3,000. It just hardly seems worth it, does it?
No, that's not a lot of money. But you would think that people that are deploying much larger botnets, much, much larger botnets, would be making exponentially a lot more money. Mm. I'm sure there is a lot of money in this. Or even just taking that personal information and then stealing money out of credit cards. I mean, you could use that information, if you weren't just selling it, to make heaps of money. Mm. I mean, I had lots of bank accounts. I could have just logged into those bank accounts and transferred all the money to somewhere. Mm. I mean, that would have been pretty easy.
Yeah. So maybe it's perhaps the guys who do the laundering and actually exploit the information, not necessarily the security box?
Yeah, I mean, my approach was more on information brokers, and just from the point of selling information. There are obviously other ways you could make money with that information.
All right, well, we're going to have some questions after we've done these little interview things, but please thank panellist Paul Craig.
Sure, thank you.
Who's next, eh? Brett, come on up. Are you hungover?
Yeah,
No. Really?
Second con.
I don't know if you... Does anyone remember Brett's talk last year? Sort of went something like this, and here you'll see... So, good con?
Excellent. Yeah,
excellent
a lot of fun. It's going really well.
And you must be pretty stoked with the way Tokemon went last night?
Yeah, it was, like a breeze, right?
So. Actually, could I just get you to come over here a little bit more, just so we get you picked up on the microphone now? I just got, I suppose, a couple of follow-up questions about your Citrix talk. Now, I know during the talk you said it's a little bit difficult to tell how many deployments are actually affected by the issues that you demonstrated. But,
sure.
But, I mean, if you just had a gut feeling about how common this sort of issue is...
Okay, so the anonymous application access,
yeah.
You're probably looking at around, say, 50%, just finger out of the air. All the other issues are more about 90%.
Now, of course, one of the big selling points that the thin client... I mean, Citrix actually calls themselves an access control company, which of course isn't very good when anti-code is just like poning their shit through Notepad. I suppose, like, if you could tell all those guys in podcast land what to actually check for, I mean, it really is just about not running those anonymous applications, isn't it?
Well, no, that's just for the external access, but you're going to let people into your Citrix environment anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, if you've got your external users coming in and you haven't locked down the environment, then they can just, as I showed you, you know, totally take over it and go from there.
Yeah, and it is an eggs-in-one-basket sort of situation with, you know, a lot of Citrix deployments, isn't it? Because once you've got in and done PrivEsk and all of that, you're pretty much sitting on the whole
lot. Yeah, well, you're widening your exterior external perimeter to wherever they're coming from. And wherever they're coming from, yeah, as Paul showing you how easy it is to get, you know, people's key logs, they could be coming from China, Russia, Afghanistan,
and it
or
seems that
Paul's house.
It seems thin client is actually getting... renewed push in the market, thanks largely to VMware, which is pushing out its VDI.
Right.
Did you get a chance to have a look at that?
No.
Something for next year, maybe?
Yeah, perhaps, yes.
All right, panelist Brett Moore.
Thank you.
Your turn, Peter. Those of you who actually listened to the show would have heard Peter come onto the show and talk a little bit about passport security or lack thereof. And of course, we saw his talk on biometrics at this year's KiwiCon. Peter, you showed that biometric solutions, as they're deployed now, are really not particularly effective. Is that, do you think, that's a problem that's inherent in the technology, or do you think this is really that the ass clowns who are deploying this stuff are sort of rushed mid-level bureaucrats who really don't give a shit? I mean, what's at the root of this problem?
I think it's a combination of both. I mean, you know, there are some things that biometrics are really good for. Use it as a backup for an existing authentication mechanism. So you come up and you say, here's my identity, here's my PIN or password or swipe card or whatever, and here's a biometric to back it up. So if someone steals my swipe card or clones the RFID tag, which isn't that hard to do, they also have to at least do a minimum amount of work to defeat the biometric reader. But simply saying, here's my fingerprint and that's it, or here's a photo of me and that's it, nothing else needed to authenticate me, is just asking for trouble.
Okay, and I mean, how much, I suppose, blowback have you got over that passport stuff? I know it wasn't just you, Adam Laurie was involved in all of that, but has there been any movement at the station? Because, you know, if I was responsible for administering those systems and I saw your talk or saw any of that research, I think I would have crapped my spine straight up my bum hole. So, you know, have you heard much back about people actually doing stuff to fix it?
It's not, the problem is that it's almost entirely political. There's very little decision making being involved at the technological layer. And if you look at some of the quotes in the slides that I had to fly through, you know, there were technology people saying, don't do this, this is bad, here is exactly why this is going to fail. and it was completely ignored because it was all being driven by politics.
So there's not much really that you see?
I can't see any of it changing, no, because it is entirely political, and you would have to get the entire world via the ICAO to decide, you know, to unilaterally or to commonly decide everybody is going to change this.
Yeah.
And that's probably not going to happen.
What is it they say? A moose is a racehorse designed by committee?
Right.
Something like that. Anyway, look, I think that'll wrap it up just for the little blah blah with Peter. Thank you, Peter. And I guess this is the fun bit of the panel where, for you guys, you get to throw some questions up to these three, four world-class dudes right here. So this is a really good opportunity to do it, like when you're not sitting there through a haze of beer or maybe codeine and painkillers. And you can just sleep if you want. That's all right. You've earned it. So does anyone actually have any questions for the dudes?
Based on the previous talk, there were talks about, I don't know exactly how many computers the logs were from, but doing quick numbers, there's something about between 10 and 20 cents per machine in average, where you could make money based on your credit card values, etc. So how likely is it that the underground,
so say,
is worth billions of dollars, with stolen credit cards, etc.?
The industry often talks about it as
multiple billions of dollars.
Oh, multiple billions. Okay, so they're probably referring to the total.
Based on your numbers.
No. So my numbers were based on information brokerage. So actually selling a credit card. Of course, if you took the credit card itself and went out shopping, you could rack up those millions, and that's probably what those stats are based on.
Can I add a couple of cents with as well? It also depends at which level you're buying the stuff. You know, it's like sort of going out to the farmer and they're getting not a lot for the produce, and the supermarket's making all the money. So if you're pulling the stuff off end-user machines, you may not get that much. If you look at what the middlemen and the brokers and the on-sellers are selling it for, they will sell you with basically full credit card information, which is the number and date of birth and mother's maiden name and pretty basically everything you need. And you see those going for like $10, $20, $50, depending on whether it's a corporate card or a platinum card or an unlimited card or whatever the higher values of cards are. So somebody's making an awful lot of money, but it depends at which level you're working. And the money seems to be the middleman, not to be the person pulling the information off the end-user PCs.
I think the point is 50% of the people in this room could probably go out there and, you know, grab 100,000 card numbers without too much difficulty. But, yeah, exploiting that information, even if it's bank accounts, whatever, you know, you've got to find a patsy to actually go into the branch and pull the money out and maybe get wrestled to the ground by a whole bunch of, you know, agents and stuff. And then you've got to, like, go to Western Union and wire the money to, you know, fuck you stand or Kazakhstan or whatever you stand, right? And then someone's cousin's got to pick it up there and wire it back. I'm sure there's some dudes up here doing some back of the envelope calculations, figuring out, like, comparing their salary to how many card numbers they have. Up the back.
Question for Paul. While going through all the data of all the stolen information and then crunching the numbers for how much it's actually worth on, you know, the black market and criminals and all that, how many times did it cross your mind that maybe this whole thing is just a fiction created by the antivirus companies to sell more antivirus software? Because you're talking about people going out and buying the antivirus software because they think they got a virus.
Yeah.
And it looks like they're the only ones who are winning here.
Yeah, that did become quite apparent to me. I've always suspected that people buy antivirus software because, you know, they're encouraged because they have a virus. Maybe in the early days of AV, AV companies started releasing things, maybe to boost sales, maybe. I mean, it's theoretically pretty possible, right? I mean, if you work in that industry, you'd know the tricks. But, yeah, I don't know. I mean, it only made like $2,000 for some AV companies. I think,
on an interesting side note, actually, one of the most common vectors for like mass pwnage these days is actually fake
antivirus software.
Pops up and says you've been pwned by X, Y, and Z. Please enter your credit card number here, or we're going to throw your entire body through a wood chipper. You know, like they're really full on. And people, they bust out the credit card numbers, and of course they get a package that masquerades as AV. Might even do some rudimentary AV to keep the other guys' packages out. You know, that's about all they're going to do. And then it just sits there throwing up pop-ups, logging your keystrokes, you know, all that fun stuff. And that shit is everywhere. It's unbelievable.
Like, so you've got this fake AV software, right? Just sort of, but what you're stealing is worth 40 cents. So
not once you've processed their credit card number to buy the fake software.
Yeah.
But I was just wondering what shocked me, like, yes, is the incredibly low amount that people actually get for personal data.
I think
you all look really disappointed by that. You know? It's like, 40 cents for a credit card. down.
This is because personal information is actually really easy to steal on the internet. Everyone is doing this, so the price drops. The market has been saturated with people saying, hey, I got credit cards. There are heaps and heaps of web forums you can go to where people say, hey, I have like 100 credit cards for sale. And someone else says, well, I got 150 and I'm cheaper than this guy. And then so on and so forth.
So that's what Layton's doing, right? Like the guy who wrote the Trojans, like,
Yeah.
So being that you guys are good hackers, if you wanted to do something irresponsible with money,
China on Ukraine, $2,000 is a lot.
Yeah, exactly. That's a good point as well. So I mean, like Russia and China, yeah, $2,000 would probably be enough to live for a couple of months. So.
Yeah, it's a lot of rubles, people. Yeah, it's a lot of rubles.
I think the point is the Trojan probably wasn't installed to get one or two. Well, how many credit cards did you get? 150 credit cards. If people that want credit cards, they go and steal a database of 10,000 or 50,000 credit cards, and you multiply out those figures. Keyloggers are to get credentials, passwords for bank accounts, for then transferring out $5,000, $10,000, or for getting access to sensitive systems. I mean, it's not... You don't keylog to get 100...
There's a bunch of Russian and, you know, various other dudes all kicking themselves at the moment because we've seen so many SQL injection worms going around. That's just really, like, it means that those bugs are actually starting to get
a bit
disappointing for people who want to just...
So that SQL injection worm that Nick was talking about, the Asprox or whatever it is, and I think there's a new one come out that infects PHP websites because obviously there's PHP vulnerable to SQL injection. That is, to the industry today, what Code Red was to the industry in 2000, 2001. Code Red came along, everyone took server security importantly after that and said, hey, we have to patch because there's worms coming through our servers. This web application worm is now coming through, all these ASP applications, and all of a sudden there's lots of work for source code auditing and secure coding policies, but everyone's all of a sudden taking web application security seriously.
Yeah, which is bad for the bad guys, I guess.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, Paul, does iCode drop the moth Trojan and compromise code security?
That's fine. I developed ICANT to be a penetration testing tool, not a tool to let you compromise and damage. You can put one and one together. I mean, they're both there. It would theoretically actually work very well because a lot of kiosks. Most of Windows kiosk software run as administrator or a user who has privileges, so you could add a WMI event. I had a cute idea when I walked out of it. I was like, man, I should totally do this, where you have a kiosk sitting there saying, like, don't touch me, or, like,
don't touch me there. Nice. We had one over here.
Okay, all right, so I've been doing application pen testing now probably about 5 years. When we go to a client and we give them, well, typically we walk into a boardroom, I give them a big fat report and I say, you know, this is shell on this server, this is your username, this is your password, things like that. Things that are critical, things that let me really own or compromise someone, they get fixed pretty good, pretty fast. I find that developers who write applications that I break actually take things quite personally. They don't like me. I'm the dude that broke their stuff. So next time I come in and I review the next app they've written, they've catered to me exactly. You know, like the bar went from here to here, and I find maybe like one or two things. So it sort of raises awareness. You know, everyone becomes aware of it. An organization may choose to not fix a vulnerability, but the people who create the systems just don't want me to break it. It's a bit of an ego thing, or
I got to actually share an anecdote. Which was the BBS software, Adam?
EasyCom
BBS. Anyone remember EasyCom BBS?
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. So when we went to high school, we had an admin named Rowan Crow. Lovely guy. Used to pick apart EasyCom, find all sorts of shit in it, and basically ridicule the developer through its mailing system. And when the next version came out, any combination of like R Crow, Rowan Crow, for a username, it wouldn't allow it. So, and it was always this battle of him finding the like right combination of stars and like, you know, underscores to actually allow his name to go on there. And eventually, he just had to pretty much change his name if he wanted to be on the EasyCom system. But yeah, it happens. Thank you very much to the panelists. Thank you all very much for your attention.
That was the Risky Business panel at KiwiCon 2 in Wellington on Sunday. Up next, it's time for an interview with Mark Piper, or Pipes. He was at KiwiCon, and he is launching securefreedom.org. That's secure-freedom.org, and it's a website designed to help open-source developers access security knowledge and resources. So, Pipes, tell us about secure-freedom.org.
So what it is a bit of an initiative to try to get some of the expert skill set in security made available to free and open source software. The idea being is that a lot of corporations and enterprises spend a lot of money in security, but the free projects, as much as they do take security seriously to a degree, there's a lot of basics that they just don't have access to for the knowledge. So what we want to do is provide resource for them to go to, ask questions, get advice, and work with people who secure infrastructure to sort of make sure that they're on the same level.
So, I mean, I think one of the core points that you're making is that a lot of people spend a lot of time auditing open source, free open source software for use in their own enterprise, and then they don't really feed that knowledge back into the open source community. Is that sort of what you're trying to do, is get that knowledge feeding back to the development teams?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if anyone's ever done a penetration test, then what you know is that it's misconfiguration and incorrect sort of deployment that results in the hosts being compromised. Free software is not exempt to that, and they don't necessarily spend a lot of time focused on that. And part of the reason is the fact that they just don't know who to ask or where to go for some advice. So providing a central point of contact and access to people who will be able to help should definitely help improve the security on that sort of area.
Now, it's been a rough sort of 6 months for open source security, hasn't it? I mean, we had the Debian disaster and we had the Red Hat Fedora code signing box thing happening pretty quickly afterwards. Do you think that the security of free open source software has, well, the perception of the security of free open source software has taken a pretty significant hit because of this stuff?
Absolutely, especially the Fedora Red Hat incident. I mean, those guys do take security pretty seriously, and yet the key boxes, your key signing boxes, managed to get hacked, right? I mean, that's, where do you get confidence from in that?
Why were they on the network in the first place, do you think?
That's the million-dollar question and the first question asked by a lot of people. Again, though, you can't go laughing at the likes of Debian if you're a Red Hat, because you've just made an equivalent. But how do we know the Debian servers haven't been hacked or the Ubuntu key signing servers haven't been hacked? We just can't say. Transparency is pretty key, but I think a large chunk of it is just having the expert knowledge. I mean, within free software and open source software, we tend to contribute a lot of code, but not a lot of documentation and not a lot of skills and just general knowledge, which is lacking, in my opinion. So
how's this forum going to work? Is it going to be a forum? Is it going to be a series of wikis? I mean, how's the actual website going to work?
So what we're looking at is a key wiki for the main part, and then what we're doing is a track database. So what people can do is they can open tickets for their organization and or the project they're working on, and they can say, look, we're deploying a new website. We would like some experts to come and help sort of with that deployment. How they wish to engage on that individual project amongst the teams is up to them. But what we want to do is provide a way to introduce them to each other. And then once they start talking, they can sort of work through the issues.
Now, of course, open source developers are sort of quite into the idea that they're creating incredibly secure software. What makes you think they're going to listen to a bunch of dudes who start telling them how to do stuff that they already think they do well?
My feedback from the open source community and the free community so far is that they say they're more than open to it, but they've never known where to go to ask. So they might have the odd individual here and there. They might jump onto various security channels on IRC, but they've never had a trusted place that they can go and ask those questions. So I believe that they want to do the best quality that they possibly can, and whatever they do. So when it comes to security, I can imagine if they have access to some knowledge, they'd use it.
Isn't one of the problems, though, with open source security in particular, is that no one really wants to spend their weekends trawling through source code? I mean, is the idea here that it will really be information gathered from internal audits at corporations and things like that that feeds back, or are you actually hoping to stir up a bit more activity in the area and really encourage people to do further audits and things like that?
A little bit of both, to be honest. It'd be great if enterprises started feeding back into the open source community more. I think there's a perception that it must be code, it must be lines of fixes for them to do, and also just a little bit of stirring up. There's people out there that may just have an interest in security and want a place where they can do it as a hobby and not necessarily get paid for it because they're doing their day job. And that's, I mean, we've built a pretty good open community in general doing that. It's the basis of free and open source software for a large chunk of it, so I think it'll be quite successful.
Pipes, good luck with it.
Yeah, cheers, man.
That was Mark Piper there explaining the concept of secure freedom, and you can find that website at secure-freedom.org, and I wish him well on that one. Next up, it's time for this week's sponsor interview with Steve McDonald from Checkpoint Software. As it turns out, Australian vendors won't have to go through grueling evaluation processes anymore to get their products listed on the Evaluated Products List, or EPL, for government deployments. For some products, being evaluated in other countries will be enough to satisfy the new requirements specified by Australia's NSA equivalent, the Defence Signals Directorate, as Steve explains.
Checkpoint's pleased to announce that we've got our latest version of our firewall product, R65, certified and listed on the EPL. We're probably more pleased to actually announce that this may be our last listing on the EPL at that level, because moving forward, hopefully from towards the end of this year, there'll be no requirement for companies to get products recertified for EEL 4 level, sorry, 4 plus level and below.
Okay, so hang on, you get your product certified once, and then what, you rewrite a whole new version and it doesn't need to go on the EPL again? You don't need to go through the certification process to get it back on the list?
That's correct. So as long as we go through a common criteria process by another recognised authority somewhere on the globe, we do a lot of our work based out of Canada, for example, then we wouldn't need to get that recertified by DSD here, as long as it meets some of their criteria locally. So that's a massive step forward.
Yeah, so, okay, that just means that if it's okay with the Canadians and it's been through that common criteria process, then the Aussie DSD will go, yep, okay, you can be on the list.
Well, fundamentally, I'm sure it's a lot more complicated than that. And obviously, we'd always recommend customers and interested parties contact DSD directly. They've got a website. They normally respond to emails incredibly quickly. I've actually been very, very pleased with the level of responsiveness we've seen out of them.
Now, it wasn't actually DSD that evaluated things for the EPL. It was companies that they deemed, you know, sufficiently cluey to evaluate stuff on their behalf. It turned into a bit of an industry onto its own, didn't it?
That's right. There are a number of certification labs that operate, obviously, globally. There are a number of them that operate locally that we've used in the past to get various functions of our product certified. So there will still be a requirement for many companies to certify locally where there is a cryptographic obligation. For example, our disk encryption product for PCs will still need a local certification.
Yep.
Due to the very nature of that specific bit of technology.
Now, given that these organisations that do the evaluations for DSD, they're sort of like gatekeepers of sorts, and they used to charge an arm and a bloody leg, didn't they?
Well, rightfully so. They were doing very specific and focused technology evaluations with a very high risk profile. So things will obviously change in that area, but it's worth noting that where there's still a cryptographic requirement on a product, for example, we've got our full disk encryption product under our endpoint security suite, that will still require local DSD certification due to that cryptographic function.
And how did that all come about? I mean, who was pushing for these changes?
Look, I think many of the vendors have raised voice about this in the past, but also I believe that DSD have wanted to make a positive change in this area. We've been speaking to them over the last few years around this kind of direction. So it's just really good to see some progress being made.
And I imagine the guys who do the evals here are a little bit pissed off, right?
Look, I think they're probably going to be happy to remove a lot of the burden and focus more, put a lot more focus into the products that they do need to put through certification. So, you know, the timeframes can be brought down from, you know, 12 to 18 months at times and bring them right down.
Do you find that many private sector organisations actually pay any attention at all to the EPL?
Yeah, look, it's something that obviously when we certify a product, we go around and we mention that in our rounds, but very few of the local organisations, whether it be banks or other financial organisations, telcos, et cetera, really place much focus on this. It's mainly so government departments can get a tick in a box for their purchasing.
Do you think it's really a warranted sort of regulation? Do you think that the EPL actually serves us well these days?
Well, look, there's not a great additional level of guidance other than the EPL for a lot of local government departments. Whether or not we needed a local EPL, that's questionable, but it is very good to see that common sense has prevailed. Common criteria certification through an authorised partner, for example, over in Canada, should carry weight. It's a common criteria.
All right, Steve McDonald, thanks again for joining us.
Patrick, thank you very much for having me.
That was Steve McDonald from Checkpoint Software there with this week's sponsor interview. And thanks again to Checkpoint for sponsoring this week's KiwiCon special. And that's all we have time for this week. This week I want to play a track from a band that broke up something like 10 to 15 years ago. The name of the band is Three, and it was a two-piece band, bass and drums, with the bass player singing. And they were a bit of a favourite of mine on the pub scene circa 1993 to, you know, 95 or whatever. And this track is called Black, and it's from the album My Hat is a Red Saucepan. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.